figure that the federal government is better situated to manage the cost of its program that it's mandating upon us.
Governor Parnell says no to a state-run health insurance exchange. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, tribal leaders from Western villages search for funding to move as storms bring more erosion.
The westerly, northwesterly storm, we're going to get nailed hard this time. Every time we get that direction, we get nailed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at GrantStation.com.
Governor Sean Parnell has decided to let the federal government run Alaska's health insurance exchange. The exchange is required under the Affordable Care Act. It's an online marketplace that will give consumers an easy way to buy pre-approved insurance plans. Parnell says setting up a state-run exchange would be too costly. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The state hired a Boston-based consulting group to study the various exchange options. The report they produced predicts an Alaska exchange would cost a minimum of $35 million to set up. Governor Parnell says that was a big factor in his decision.
I figure that the federal government is better situated to manage the cost of its program that it's mandating upon us.
Parnell is a big opponent of the Affordable Care Act. He joined 26 states in suing to overturn the law, but the Supreme Court largely upheld it last month. Parnell was the only governor who turned down a $1 million grant the federal government offered early on to take the first steps towards an insurance exchange. The federal government is also offering tens of millions of dollars to states in additional money to help establish exchanges. But Parnell says he's not interested.
Well, certainly they made an offer, but nothing is ever free when it comes from the federal government. So I figured they could spend their money on federal employees doing that work rather than us trying to use some of their money, some of our money, and trying to get to, you know, an approval of an exchange system here. They're much better situated to deal with their own mandates than we are.
The federally run health insurance exchange will be tailored for Alaska. And Parnell says even that option will cost the state some money. Fewer than 15 states so far have already set up state-run exchanges or are in the process of doing it. They're required to be up and running by January 1st, 2014. Senator Hollis French, a Democrat from Anchorage, has been a big supporter of a state-run exchange. He says Alaska will miss out by turning over the job to the feds.
The argument for a state-run health exchange all along has been that it's something that's designed by Alaskans for Alaskans and not imposed upon us by Washington, D.C.
French worries that under a federally run exchange, Alaskans won't be eligible for the rich subsidies the Affordable Care Act provides for purchasing insurance. The law is unclear on that point, and experts disagree on how it will ultimately be interpreted. French is also worried the federal government won't do as good a job making sure uninsured Alaskans use the exchange. And that's a real concern, according to Taylor Burke, a national health policy expert at George Washington University, who's a big supporter of the law.
The state knows its people better, and the state's going to be able to do outreach better and marketing better to find those living in communities of lower socioeconomic status that need help getting into the actual exchange system. Now, if the feds roll in and try to do this, they're not going to have the institutional knowledge of what communities and what counties and what neighborhoods need the most attention.
Burke thinks Governor Parnell is making a big mistake.
A state that decides not to set up an exchange because they are politically against the Affordable Care Act runs up against the very ironic problem that by doing nothing for political reasons, you are actually inviting the federal government in to do it for you. So that, in fact, will invite more government intervention than less.
Governor Parnell agrees with Burke. That is a concern, but he says the federal exchange will have to operate under state law, so the cost factor outweighed worries over intrusion by the federal government. The governor is still debating another big Affordable Care Act decision, whether to expand Medicaid. The federal government is paying nearly 100% of the cost of the expansion for the first 3 years, but Parnell is worried that isn't a sure deal.
I think it's fair to say that if I had to make the decision today, I would not expand Medicaid for concern over costs and the uncertain future of Medicaid on the federal side. So I do have significant concerns about costs being shifted to the states under any expansion.
The expansion would allow about 30,000 additional low-income Alaskans to qualify for Medicaid. Parnell says he'll probably wait until after the November election to make the decision. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska Native leaders are in Washington, D.C. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, they're advocating for federal help to deal with the effects of climate change.
The thawing permafrost in Shishmaref is having a harsh effect on the community of less than 600 people. Land is eroding away at a rapid clip, falling year after year, chunk by chunk, into the Chukchi Sea. Village leaders need to relocate the entire population. Stanley Toktu is the president of the Shishmaref IRA Council.
It'd be better to move sooner because, you know, we can't tell what the next storm will bring because the westerly, northwesterly storm, we're going to get nailed hard this time. Every time we get that direction, we get nailed.
Toktu is worried that relocating the village will also erode the traditional culture, with residents opting to move to Kotzebue or Nome instead. He's in Washington, D.C., asking Alaska's congressional delegation for money. Toktu says he's also looking to the state for help. Stanley Tom, the tribal administrator for Nutuk, is also in Washington, D.C., lobbying for federal help for his village relocation, also because of climate change. He says he's been promised money for years for roads and an airport, but nothing has materialized. So Nutuk is looking to private business for help.
So we're excited to have to get the funding any way we can, besides federal and state. You know, I think private sector will be a very beneficial to my tribe, so it wouldn't be regulated like the state and federal government.
Tom did not say which businesses the village is negotiating with or what specifically they do. He expects to have more details available in the next couple of weeks. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Douglas Indian Association yesterday held a blessing ceremony at Gastineau Community School for human remains found during a renovation project. Last month, the city and borough of Juneau halted construction after workers digging in front of the building unearthed remains and a headstone for Sam Goldstein, a Chilkat man from Klukwan who died in 1927. It turns out the remains did not belong to Goldstein, whose body is still missing. At the request of Douglas Indian Association officials, the city brought in archaeologists from the Northern Land Use Research in Fairbanks. They correctly identified the remains found near Goldstein's headstone as those of a young woman in her early to mid-20s. Deputy City Manager Rob Steedle says they also used ground-penetrating radar to scan the construction area.
They were able to identify six probable sites for graves and four possible sites, as well as a number of other sites where they just couldn't tell what was going on. But they thought they were unlikely to be graves.
Steedle confirms additional human remains were found, but declined to give an exact number. He says construction will resume at the school this week, and the city is reasonably confident no other burial sites will be disturbed. He also says the city will work with Douglas Indian Association to investigate how the sites went unnoticed for several decades. Gastineau Community School was built in 1957.
The records are scant, but we will be doing research to understand just what was visible on that site in the late 1950s when Gastineau School was built.
Members of the Juneau Assembly and School Board attended Tuesday's blessing ceremony as guests of Douglas Indian Association, but Steedle says DIA officials requested that it not be noticed to the public in order to keep the gathering small and private. Douglas Indian Association officials could not be reached for comment before news time. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, searching for beach treasures at Critter Camp in Sitka.
A mussel. Yeah, he's called a blue mussel because that's what color he kind of looks, doesn't he? Right here? Yeah.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
NOAA scientists are combing Alaska beaches again in their search for marine debris from the 2011 tsunami that hit Japan. Five scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are in the Yakutat area this week, where they will be walking several miles each day. After Yakutat, they'll head to the Cordova area, Kayak Island, and Montague Island in south-central Alaska. Jacek Masalko is the lead scientist. In an interview before the group left, he said NOAA has previous data from many of the beaches, so they will be able to see how things change over time.
We're going to specific spots that we've surveyed in the 2008 and I think 98 and then 92 and prior years. So those are exact specific beaches, shoreline segments that we have surveyed in the past. So we will have a pretty good long-term distribution of the density and the composition of the debris that's found on those specific beaches.
Masalko says he intends to look for tsunami debris over as much of the Gulf of Alaska shoreline as possible this summer and revisit many of the same areas next summer. So far, most of what they've cataloged is common stuff. But in the June survey, the scientists found a number of large black, yellow, and orange oval buoys, which they believe to be part of the Japanese fish farming industry. A town hall meeting to discuss recent police shootings in Anchorage is set for tomorrow. Officials, including the police chief and the mayor, plan to attend. Community organizers say it is a step in the right direction. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Organizers say the town hall meeting is meant to promote communication between the Anchorage Police Department and the communities impacted by the recent shootings. The meeting is being coordinated by the Anchorage Community Police Relations Task Force. Reverend Dr. William Green is the chair of that group.
We got five people that will speak from the Polynesian community. After, then we'll have a word of prayer. Then we'll get into discussion.
June 9th, an Anchorage police officer shot and killed Shane Tosse, a Samoan man who was brandishing a stick in the Mountain View neighborhood, saying the stick was a deadly weapon. An investigation by a branch of the Attorney General's office cleared the officer involved of any criminal charges. A toxicology report released Tuesday by the Anchorage Police Department shows the presence of alcohol, marijuana, and synthetic cannabinoids such as K2 and spice in his system. In addition, police say Tosse's blood alcohol level was more than twice the legal limit. The shooting sent shockwaves through the community. Miriama Amavai is with the newly formed Polynesian Community Center. She'll speak at the meeting.
What I hope, you know, to come out of this meeting is pretty much answers from the Anchorage Police Department and government officials on, you know, protocols and policies. You know, we wanted to pretty much have concerned citizens and everyone, like the community, to come and voice, you know, have a voice and really speak and seek answers for themselves from government officials. And then also the other goal was to, you know, start the healing process, you know, like a starting point.
Amavai says the toxicology report released Tuesday just reaffirms her belief that Anchorage Police Department protocols need to be reviewed, especially for dealing with people under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Anchorage Police spokesman Lieutenant David Parker says the synthetic drugs Tosse was using may explain why he was acting out of character. The town hall meeting on the shootings is set for Thursday at the Lusac Library Assembly Chambers Conference Room from 5:30 to 7:30. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A Juneau photographer has donated a large collection of his father's work to a Southeast Alaska cultural group. The archive documents the career of Amos Wallace, a nationally known Tlingit carver. It will be used to teach a new generation of artists about traditional and more recent techniques. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Amos Wallace was a keeper. So his longtime home on Juneau's Douglas Island held numerous documents from his nearly 70-year career. Since he and his wife Dorothy passed away, their son Brian has been going through the collection.
I was in the basement earlier this part of this year, and I opened up some boxes and stuff, and I saw some photos that I've never seen before, and unfortunately I saw this.
This was a pair of black and white historic photographs showing the elder Wallace with a totem pole he carved in Cincinnati, Ohio. Both were badly damaged by water.
So I did not want this disaster to happen to the rest of the collection, so I immediately started putting everything together, making and organizing the archive, and then I took it down to Sealaska Heritage, and now it's in a very safe place where it will be preserved for generations.
The Juneau-based Heritage Institute preserves and advances Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian culture. It's planning a new building, the Walter Soboloff Center, to house a growing physical collection, a digital library, classrooms, and display space. That will include the Wallace Collection.
In terms of going out and meeting the rest of the world, Amos was that ambassador for Tlingit people, for Tlingit art.
Rosita Worrell is the Institute's president. She says Amos Wallace was an important artist and craftsman.
He definitely brought attention to our art in, you know, nationally and internationally.
And it certainly takes a person with character to do that.
Zachary Jones is archivist and collections manager for the Institute. He says Wallace was enthusiastic about his culture and generous with his knowledge.
He was there sort of showcasing Alaska statehood, as sort of this Alaska Native representative to different people across the nation on the Tonight Show, at museums, really sort of an individual teaching the lower 48 about Alaska Native art.
Jones and Worrell say the collection is comprehensive, something that's not often seen in Tlingit art. It includes notes, drawings, photographs, and newspaper clippings.
You get to see a breadth of the artist's life. You can see the evolution of his work from an early age to his latter years. You can really see the beauty, the depth, and aspects of his life that I think we really like to celebrate.
Amos Wallace began carving under the tutelage of his older brother Lincoln when he was 7 years old. He went to the old Wrangell Institute boarding school, where he studied with respected carver Horace Marks. He served in the Army in World War II, then spent more than a decade with his brother carving small totems for a Pacific Northwest wholesaler. As the collection shows, he moved on to a larger stage.
This is the totem pole that is now in the Brooklyn Children's Museum.
Brian Wallace, Amos's son, pulls up a digitized photo from his father's collection.
He carved this totem pole in New York City in 1958 for a big department store in Brooklyn called Abraham and Strauss. A lot of several local people in town who grew up like said, "Hey, yeah, I know that. They probably even went and saw my dad carving at one time when they were little kids."
The elder Wallace did more than carve when he was in New York. He talked to school children and others about his art, culture, and traditions. That led to his Tonight Show appearance, back when it was hosted by Jack Parr. The department store totem later moved to a new location, the Brooklyn Children's Museum. Brian Wallace pulls up another photo showing his dad wearing a traditional Chilkat blanket and a woven spruce root hat.
This photo was taken the day the totem pole is dedicated. He's there with a little girl. He's got this, you know, Tlingit words for new totem pole, you know, words for my country, Alaska, and Tlingit here.
The Amos Wallace collection also documents totem carvings at Disneyland, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and museums in Cincinnati, Toronto, and Boston. Parts of the collection are more personal, showing Alaska Native Brotherhood events or Orthodox Church services. Then there's family photos, including one showing Amos taking his younger son Brian to his first day of kindergarten. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Alaska Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals is looking for a new building. The only no-kill shelter in Anchorage closed its adoption center 6 weeks ago following a gas leak. The leak was one of many problems that ultimately convinced the SPCA Board of Directors to abandon the rickety old building. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reports.
The faded red series of buildings that housed the Alaska SPCA Adoption Center was in really bad shape. There were cracks in the flooring, some of the drywall was rotting out, and areas of the roof were falling in. Maureen O'Neill, the center's executive director, says just before the gas leak, the SPCA board of directors were worried it wouldn't stand up to the weather.
It's been kind of put together with hope and duct tape over the years, and that's not enough.
6 weeks ago, a gas leak was the final straw. No animals were hurt, but the board of directors decided to vacate the building before something more catastrophic happened. At the time, the SPCA was housing about 30 dogs and cats. O'Neill says that they could graciously move the cats into the visitor's center, but the dogs required more attention.
It wasn't a matter of just let's get them out here and into any type of environment. It took some time for the dogs to find their homes, and some of them have had a little bit more challenges than your average shelter dog.
The SPCA has adopted out all those animals, but they still don't have a new adoption facility. And O'Neill says that the solution isn't as easy as finding a new building. They need a good location that people can find easily to drop off animals. They need enough ventilation to avoid spreading disease through the kennels.
And it's just, it's expensive to build. So money absolutely is an issue. And there are no easy answers on how you raise a couple million dollars. And it's probably more than a couple million that we need to raise.
The Alaska SPCA received no monetary help from the government. O'Neill says they depend on donations and community support. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonasson.
A series of camps are taking place this summer at the Sitka Sound Science Center. They cover water, marine life, the forest, and even flight, all parts of daily life in Southeast Alaska. The idea is to reinforce what the students have already learned in school and maybe even prepare them for the upcoming year. And to have fun. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
When the tide goes out behind the Sitka Sound Science Center, it reveals a rocky tidal flat. It is a wide expanse of kelp, driftwood, and stones, dotted by pools of seawater. It is an invitation to draw closer to the silvery ocean under the safe blanket of low-hanging gray clouds. It is, quite possibly, one of the most serene places in Sitka. Most of the time.
Oh my God, what?
It's like this big!
I'm not kidding, we're not
kidding! Whoa!
This is Critter Camp.
Look at that!
Put on by the Sitka Sound Science Center, and as the name might suggest, there are 17 children right now, all entering first or second grade next year, combing the tide pools for, well, critters. A young girl walks up to instructor Ashley Bulwark. The girl is holding something in her hand.
A mussel. Yeah, he's called a blue mussel because that's what color he kind of looks, doesn't he? Right here? Yeah. All right, can you put him back where you found him?
Why?
Because where does he live?
In the water.
Right, where you found him, in the water.
The students spend time as a group, and then, under the careful eyes of camp staff and a few volunteers, they wander freely looking for more critters. Alex Bailey is one of them. He's higher up on the beach than the rest of the students.
Well, I didn't bring my boots.
But that has not stopped him from finding plenty to look at.
Well, I did find a shell that was alive, and there was a little crab in it that never opened, but he was trying to keep his water inside his shell so he can be wet.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So why does a crab do that?
I don't know, because he likes to be in water. He wants to be in water, mm-hmm. and he doesn't like to be in air and dry.
Alex says he likes looking for critters on the beach, And he's not alone.
I love tide pooling, and I feel right at home with them because they're like, look at this! And I'm like, no way, what did you find? And I'm just really excited all the time.
That is Ashley Bulwark. Officially, she is the logistics coordinator at the Science Center, but the kids call her Miss Ashley. So, Miss Ashley and Miss Elena.
My name is Elena Avery. I am the AmeriCorps volunteer at the Sitka Sound Science Center.
They both have backgrounds in biology and a lot of curiosity. Both Miss Ashley and Miss Elena agree that some of the most fun they have comes when kids ask them a question and they do not know the answer.
And the kids love when they stump the instructor or stump the teacher. And they'll find something and I'll go, I don't know what that is. And I'll have to flip through my field guide and try to figure out what it is. So there's still new stuff.
There were a few camps on the menu this summer. Critter Camp joins programs about water, flight, and the forest. They serve students as young as the ones we met up to those entering fifth grade. There is an aquarium camp set for August, too. That is designed for students in grades 6 through 8. The idea, says Miss Elena, Avery, is to reinforce the things the students learn in their regular classrooms, or, in some cases, to prepare them for the coming year.
If it's something that they've already covered in school, if it's something in summer camp, they can say, oh my gosh, I already know this. I already know what a mammal is. And they can be the kid that is helping explain things. Or hopefully maybe next year, if they're talking about photosynthesis, it's not just this big scary word. It's something that they've seen before in camp. They've kind of experienced it. So it's not as intimidating and they can go in and learn more.
There's also the hope that what's happening now at a very young age could plant the seeds for a lifelong interest in science. After all, the people teaching the camp now were once influenced by science teachers. For Bulwark, it was in the fourth grade.
Her name was Miss DeBall. She was just wonderful, had a ton of energy, and she was actually my science teacher for fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and lots and lots of fun every year. It was great.
And for Avery?
As a little child, my science camp was Long Island Sound with my grandfather. So he takes credit for that, and I'll give it to him. But in junior high and high school, I had Dr. Carroll as my chemistry professor, and she had us do projects like make a three-dimensional periodic table. And it helped a lot, and that building really helped get the concepts across.
So someday is some kid going to be sitting in a science center somewhere talking to a radio reporter saying, Miss Elena and Miss Ashley helped me find the chitin on the beach?
I sure hope so.
I hope so.
That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Awesome. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly, Rosemary Alexander, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Wendy Jonathan from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.